In mid-December 1976, a series of repeated days of below-zero temperatures caused Lake Erie to freeze over. The same frigid conditions continued deep into January 1977, under which freezing, refreezing, and thawing was not in the equation. This left unusual mountains of powdery snow sitting on top of Lake Erie in an ominous white landscape that stretched for miles, just waiting for the most unlikely and bizarre scenarios to occur, which would set in motion something ugly and unforgettable. On January 28th, a blizzard, nothing unusual, but a blizzard, dumping 12 inches of snow on Buffalo, New York, was met with sustained 75-mile-an-hour winds that blew all of that pre-existing snow that was sitting on top of Lake Erie in the direction of Buffalo while the blizzard was taking place. The thruway was shut down. Roads were unpassable. Cars were stuck. Ran out of gas. People froze. People died. And it became the second worst snowstorm in recorded history. We didn't get pounded in New Jersey that weekend, but I do remember the weather being rather shitty. I mean, I don't remember every detail. I mean, I was 6 years old. But the passage of time is good for turning your memories into fragments of a jigsaw puzzle. Still images like snapshots that don't always fit together, but they remind you just enough to let you know that you were there. I remember sleeping at my aunt and uncle's house. I remember sitting in the booth of a Polynesian restaurant. I remember seeing the violent and gory shootout at the end of Operation Daybreak on television. And I remember seeing an advertisement, a commercial for the upcoming Kiss concert at Madison Square Garden. I had just recently gotten into Kiss, much to the horror of my parents and every other adult in my life. Kiss was 3 years into their career as recording artists, and they were about to play the Garden for the very first time. Fragmented, still frame 77 is as far as my memory goes. That was 1977. In a few more months, Star Wars would be the biggest movie on the planet, a phenomenon unlike anything ever seen in the history of cinema. At the end of the year, another phenomenon of a different kind would spill heavily into 1978 and feed the myth of 1977 that's been bugging me like a massive pain in my ass. This myth, you know, of 1977 being the year that disco broke and punk broke. And when we say break, we mean mainstream craze. The mass introduction of something to the mainstream that's been going on for a very long time already. Very often it means a new overexposure and bastardization. And very often it spells the end of something, when in fact it's just the beginning for a lot more people than the cool people like you and me, and the cool people we hang out with. You know, when you put together a rock and roll podcast and you claim that despite the insanity that often looms over your subject matter, that your discussions are serious and intelligent in nature, and sometimes it helps to find guests who can actually help you get there. When I knew we were doing an episode on the effect of disco on rock music, I envisioned a massive forum of a bunch of rock-centric minds reminiscing on the 1970s. And that would be our cast of characters, Pat Ivanitsky, Stick Nixon, and yours truly. I thought about reaching out to Steve Dahl, the guy who blew up all those records at Comiskey Park. But I didn't want to play that angle, you know, I didn't want to sensationalize our subject. I did reach out to Giorgio Moroder, but his publicist told me that Giorgio isn't doing any press at this time, and that she would circle back when he is doing press, basically when he has something to plug, and Giorgio Moroder gets to talk about Giorgio Moroder. But I don't have any interest in talking to Giorgio Moroder about Giorgio Moroder. I thought it would be kind of cool to have his voice and his view toward an analytic, academic, intellectual, and philosophical discussion on disco. That's all. And it was then that I realized that that was the approach that I wanted to take. And as I was cross-referencing three or four books, I realized that Alice Eccles was the person I wanted to talk to. Out of the handful of publications that I was going through when I was preparing for this episode, it was Alice Eccles' book Hot Stuff that kind of spoke to me in my own language. And that's one of history and one of chronology and one of a timeline that kind of cuts across pop culture with a sense of how and why things happen. I tracked down Alice out near the desert. They have email out there. And they have cell phones, which made it very easy to communicate as we put this thing together. She expressed some concern, and I always get concerned about the use of cell phones on the air, but I assured her that we'd sound awesome. This is a low-budget podcast, you know, but we do sound awesome, except for those nasty S's and P's that Pat and I kill you with all the time. You know, low-budget technology at my fingertips. We could use a de-esser and some P-screens, but, you know, I got to make do with some compression and a low-pass filter here and there. But moving forward, Alice Eccles is professor of history and the Barbara Streisand Chair of Contemporary Gender Studies at USC. She is the author of 4 books, with a 5th coming in October. Her books include Daring to be Bad, Radical Feminism in America, 1967 to 1975, Shaky Ground, the 60s and its Aftershocks, Scars of Sweet Paradise, The Life and Times of Janis Joplin, and the book that lends itself to our topic, Hot Stuff, Disco and the Remaking of American Culture. We hit disco left and right and top to bottom. My initial aim was to approach disco from the viewpoint of rock fans, but I realized that I loved the music enough to not have to take that angle. Alice and I found that we're both steeped in the history of rock and roll, although Alice's roots and knowledge of disco, R&B, and soul leave me floored. Neither of us adhere to a rock-centric view of disco, and we prefer to cut across and assess it as an historical period, one of great influence and impact on pop culture, and not just a rude interruption of rock and roll. I was privileged to be able to speak with Alice Eccles earlier this month. It was at a time when Rock Under Fire's schedule was tight, as it still is. Summertime is a little tough for our cast to assemble once every 2 weeks, let alone twice in 1 week. So I had to move on this. So I'm flying solo here. My co-hosts will return for part 2 of this 2-part series we call the Disco Years. The mayhem and all that is entailed in a normal Rock Under Fire episode will resume as scheduled. Until then, enjoy the next 90 minutes. I guarantee this will be the best discussion on disco that you've ever heard on a rock podcast. Probably the only of its kind. So with that, let's go to my talk with Alice Eccles.
No, Alice.
So, Alice, I'd like to welcome you.
That would not be a properly rock and roll attitude,
I think. Badass, man. But I'd like to welcome you, Alice, to the Rock Under Fire podcast. I'm glad that I got you for this, first off, because your book encapsulates the entire era very nicely that we're talking about in this topic. And, you know, you've explored the era extensively with that scholarly approach, which is so important when you're examining anything that lends itself to advancing our knowledge and understanding of something. So I needed you to be my go-to person for this. So thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here, Mike.
Yeah, we're talking about disco and, to get right into it, I mean, it's something that was considered, I guess it was in your book, where it was either your quote or you quoting somebody, but it was just, you know, considered mindless and repetitive and formulaic and banal, yet it was a hotbed of social change, and in many ways it informed pop culture for the rest of the decade. And what was it about disco? What were the main components that made that initial impact enough to to be the bedrock of an entire subculture and then eventually consume all of pop culture within a decade.
You know, yes, it does consume all of pop culture briefly. And then, of course, it is pretty much killed off. But it's a fascinating story. I mean, one of the reasons that, I mean, I had several reasons for wanting to call the book Hot Stuff. Obviously, there was a song called Hot Stuff that was cut by the Rolling Stones. And then a few years later, Donna Summer, the disco diva, put out a very different song called Hot Stuff.
Right.
So in some sense, you know, that was what I was playing with. But I was also trying to give a sense that of the fact that disco was itself hot. You know, that there was a hotness around disco. And I locate that hotness, really, I would say, in a few areas, and I focus on those areas. And one of them is really the way in which disco, in so many ways, upended the kind of racial rules and the gender and sexual conventions that typified America. Disco really does, I think, broaden the contours of what was understood to be blackness, of femininity, and also, and this is what I really focus on in the book, is male homosexuality. And so those three areas are the ones that I really focus upon, that I really spend a good deal of time on. And you know, when you're thinking about the kind of backlash to disco, it's really, really complicated. I do think that to some extent it had to do with the fact that what you find in disco, you know, if you really try to trace the lineage, the history of disco, you have to go really all the way back to Motown, which, you know, in the scheme of things, we're only talking a few years, of course.
Right.
But you have to go back to Motown. You have to look at how Motown's music is then, to some extent, supplanted by a slightly sweeter kind of soul music coming out of Philadelphia, Philadelphia International Records and Gamble and Huff, which would prove to be very influential. Remember David Bowie's Fame, actually, and that move on Young Americans grew up. I mean, that happened as a result of his exposure to the soul music of Philadelphia.
Right.
But these African American musicians and producers who were responsible for helping to create what becomes disco were really experimenting with a kind of, you know, lavish, sophisticated arrangements that didn't always sound to some listeners' ears. And I think probably, especially to white rockers' ears, it didn't sound recognizably black. And I think that proved very problematic for white rockers who expected soul music to sound more like old-style James Brown, Otis Redding. There's a kind of naturalism that they, I think, attributed to that soul music. It was hot, it was sweaty. It wasn't a kind of music that they associated with really these sort of, as I said, lavish, sophisticated arrangements. And look at Barry White. I mean, Barry White is a kind of epitome of disco. That
right.
guy, I don't think when he performed
the love theme,
you know, the love man. I mean, he never sweated, right? I mean, he was like the opposite of James Brown, right?
Yeah.
James Brown, the hardest working man in show business. And it's true. You can find any clip of James Brown.
I'll tell you, he was sweating Barry White because he was really trying to fit into the whole disco thing. It was kind of like if you can't beat him, join him type of thing around 76. Wasn't that the case with James Brown?
Yes. I mean, James Brown had the most ambivalent relationship to disco. I mean, he hated it, but he wanted to be a part of it. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you can get diametrically opposed views of disco from James Brown, depending upon the source, depending upon the year. But he did resent it, and he resented the fact that here you have this, you know, this, I'm sure he thought, I mean, I shouldn't say that, but I know he resented Barry White. He calls him out in one of his songs. And I think partly he must have hated Barry White for his, well, the fact that he didn't have to work the way that James Brown did, you know? And, you know, I suspect that James Brown's, I mean, the kind of music that I think James Brown really, really liked really wasn't disco. You know, but Barry White was one of the sort of creators of disco, and the people that he worked with, like Gene Page, who most people don't know very much about, and very little has been written about. But these were people who, in some sense, and I would say this is true of Gamble and Huff at Philadelphia International Records, these are people who want to expand the palette of the sort of musical palette of what's available to African Americans. Why can't we create music that sounds more like Burt Bacharach? You know, why can't we? Why do we have to always sound like, you know, Otis Redding? It's, you know, it's not unlike, although it's very different from, but it's not unlike what Jimi Hendrix said. You know, I don't have to play soul music. I don't got to. And there he was referencing Otis Redding and, you know, and everybody else, yeah, but mostly yeah. Otis. And so there was a kind of, with disco, I would argue, for many performers and arrangers and producers, there was a kind of rebellion against the notion that black people and black music had to sound recognizably black. You could see this with Stevie Wonder complaining about why it is that he, you know, it's like, why can't I do country music? I love country music. So in some sense, I'm not saying that most of white America understood this. And I'm not sure to what extent every disco artist by any means was motivated by this, but I think some of them were, and you can find indeed interviews with Gamble and Huff in which they talk about, and they really are kind of proto disco, and then they, you know, their music really does move sort of full tilt into disco, where they talk about their resentment of white rock critics telling them or telling the world that their music isn't really black. It's like, where do you get off?
Yeah, where do we get off? I mean, it all came, it's all black music. I mean, look, I mean, where would the Stones be without Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely true. So one of the things that, and so, okay, so I'm somebody who lived through the disco era. I mean, I was a DJ during it, and I listened obsessively because I came out of the 60s rock culture. I mean, I wrote a book and that was published in 99 on Janis Joplin.
Right.
So I understood the rock aesthetic.
You know when you acknowledged that the Stones wrote a song called Hot Stuff first, I was like, okay, she knows her shit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, Jefferson Airplane, all those San Francisco bands, the Stones. I mean, I got the Stones' first album when I was growing up, you know, outside of D.C. But I always listened very widely. I had big ears. And so growing up in D.C., I listened when I was a high schooler. I listened a lot to the soul music stations, more than I did to anything else, because at that moment, and here we're talking, you know, 67, 68, 69, you know, you didn't yet really have classic, you know, you didn't have rock stations. You had the beginning of those underground stations, right, on the FM dial.
Right.
But if you wanted to hear Janis Joplin, if you wanted to hear The Doors, you would hear them to some extent on Top 40, right, or those cuts that were single cuts, but you know, a lot of the best music was really, if you were growing up, if you were a teenager and, you know, if you were a high school senior in 69, the way that I was, there's an awful lot of great music being played on, you know, WOL in Washington, D.C.
Well, at that point, it was album-oriented rock. So you had the album format where if you were lucky enough to have a station in your city that did album cuts. And I guess, I know growing up in the 70s and 80s, that was the case with me where, radio for me was, you would hear the singles, but you would also hear, you know, the DJs had some sort of say over the playlist.
That's
wasn't,
right.
It wasn't corporatized
right.
yet.
That's exactly right. Now, growing up in D.C., I do remember one day very, very clearly, and I write about it in the Janus book. I remember turning the dial and coming across this really low wattage station. And it was, it turned out, I think it was in Gaithersburg, Maryland. It was a ways away. And the reason that I stopped there was that I heard Janis Joplin. I was like, holy, who is this, right? I mean, I don't think I had heard about her yet. And so that was one of, that was the, in that area, that was the first such FM station. I'm not sure it was FM, actually. It was the first such station that I ever tuned into. And then, of course, we had this revolution in radio where FM, which had been where all the educational radio stations had been, that all shifts and changes, right? And you find all of these, you know, sort of underground stations that become enormously popular and sort of pave the way for classic rock, or what becomes classic rock.
Right.
But so anyway, I think it's really complicated understanding the resistance of rock and rollers to disco. I mean, I think that there is this sort of feeling that it's not the soul music that they grew up with. And again, there's a real resistance, I think, to sort of expanding notions of what constitutes black identity. I'm not saying that it's just, you know, white rock and rollers who feel that. I mean, look at George Clinton. George Clinton, with his P-Funk group, they do One Nation Under Groove, which I always loved. It was perhaps their biggest hit, I think, or one of them. Yet they saw it as, like, cashing in on the disco craze.
Yeah, at that point, you know? Casablanca was, like, the big gold mine during those years. So it was Casablanca. Was P-Funk, was that... Were they one of the Casablanca artists? I know it was like the Village People and Donna Summer at that point. Seems like they had taken
P-Funk,
over.
Yeah, P-Funk is complicated because, you know, there are all kinds of contractual problems. George Clinton was a very sharp guy. And as I recall, I don't quite remember this part of the story, but I think that there was a reason that... he ended up with two groups, Parliament and Funkadelic. And I
right.
think it had to do with contractual problems with a small Detroit record label. But at one point in time, one of those groups, at least, was definitely on Casablanca, yeah. But this is to say, it's not just white people who have certain ideas about what constitutes black music. You know, look at Greg Tate, or look at whose work I love. But there's, maybe it wasn't Greg Tate, so I'll take that back. but there was Nelson George, whose work, you know, I also love, but who's written very, very critically of disco. Look at Chuck D of Public Enemy, who, you know, was withering in his critique of disco. So, I mean, across the board, its hotness lies in the fact that it's uncomfortable for people, both white and black, for the ways that it is expanding, as I said, the musical palette. So there's that. You know, it's producers' music at a point in time when rock is not about producers' music, right? It's about having wrested control from producers and seemingly from the music industry, although of course it hadn't, you know?
Yeah.
And so there was this fear that, you know, we were going back to bubblegum, right? And then I do think that certainly a lot of Americans were clueless about the connection between disco and homosexuality. Completely clueless, right?
Right.
But not everybody was. And some people did know that, that the early adopters of disco music were urban gay men, many of them men of color. Not exclusively so, but these were interracial clubs usually in big cities and particularly starting out in New York. And so there was this awareness, and you can see it, you know, if you look at punk magazine, you look at some of the, you know, there's some really vicious anti-gay, discophobic, homophobic stuff that comes out.
It got pretty vicious in the 70s during as far as disco going from that underground thing to exploding in mainstream America. Yeah, the backlash was nasty.
Yeah, and what I hadn't really realized at the time was to what extent hard right conservatives, some of them, were beginning to develop attacks on disco precisely because they saw it as ramping up sexuality, and in particular, quote unquote, deviant sexuality. So I hadn't really understood that. But people, you know, the thing about disco is, you know, you could talk to a white rock and roller who would say, oh, I hate disco. You know, it sucks. You know, and it sucks because, you know, it's so conventional. And in fact, there's a quote in my book from somebody who says, you know, it's so conventional, Richard Nixon would have loved it, right? And then you could go to Anita Bryant, you know, who waged that anti-gay campaign in Florida. You know, she was the celebrity who, you know, was selling orange juice and stuff for the citrus industry. And then she became this, you know, this kind of icon of the religious right attacking gays and lesbians. And she hated disco. So people across the ideological spectrum, they became sort of united in their dislike and their dislike of disco.
Which goes to show, which is like a mind-boggling question as to why, if it was considered conventional on one hand, and then, you know, if this those put that person, you know, have them walk into the Stonewall in 1969, or just experience the total debauchery of Studio 54 in 77, 78, you know, come out and say, well, is that conventional? Is that your idea of, you know,
But that's why it's so hot. That's the hotness, is that, you know, people attacked it from all over the place. But I guess one of the things that I find really, really interesting about it is that a couple of things. One is that I think you can't make sense of the response to disco and the discophobia that was unleashed without taking on board what else was happening in American culture.
Right.
And, you know, I think that to the extent that disco became connected to, associated with gay men, with women, because we all know that at least among white people, it tends to be women who are more comfortable dancing than men.
Yeah.
I mean, there are exceptions, but, you know, and I don't mean to grossly generalize, but you know, there's been an awful lot, at least anecdotally,
want to expand on one thing I said regarding the conventional comment that I was speaking to. You know, my point was coming from the viewpoint of somebody, not me. I'm just saying that somebody would think it would be conventional that certain things like the Stonewall and things that go on at 54 from, you know, as far whether it be legend or myth or fact, would be considered aberrant from mainstream thought, from the average Joe sitting in his living room in suburban Anytown, USA, you know, would be considered a little crazy as opposed to conventional. So that's where I was coming from with that.
I totally agree with you there. But I think that it depends on what you're looking at. And I don't think that person was thinking really about how it played out in the club scene, probably didn't even know about it.
Right.
But I think that person was reacting to the fact that the record industry seemed to be dropping rock or less interested in rock, more interested in music that to him seemed prefab, seemed overproduced, and that venues for rock, live rock and roll were diminishing. So I think, you know, there's so many people's reactions to disco. One of the reasons they're so multivalent, that there's so many people come at it from, it's like it's too conventional. It is, you know, it's not conventional enough, right?
Yeah, well, depending on who's judging it.
Yeah, it's working in so many ways in American culture, you know?
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons that people had the reaction that they had, or those that didn't like disco had the reaction that they had, was the sort of larger backdrop, you know?
Right.
The effectively, the loss in Vietnam, which I think cannot be exaggerated in terms of, this is the first war that the U.S. had ever lost. There was also the sense, I think, among some, I think in some ways, you know, music very often, when you look at musical culture, you can see some of, it sometimes prefigures change. And so in some sense, these wars around disco were part of, and most people don't see this, but I think they were part of a larger culture war. And I think for a lot of hardcore white, particularly perhaps, I don't know if one could say particularly working class or not, but for a lot of white men, I mean, this was certainly true in Detroit, you know, where a lot of the disco resistance was really strong. It was taking place not only in the context of a loss in Vietnam, but also deindustrialization and the rust belting of their hometowns and their cities. It's like, well, what are we going to do? And on top of that, also the sense that I think some white people had that minorities were getting ahead. There was this thing called affirmative action, right? And women were getting ahead. And, you know, so there was a sense of, and again, it's a kind of beginning of what we find ourselves in now with some white, some members of the white working classes in this country feeling like they're strangers in their own land. It's like, what's happened to our radio stations? They're all playing disco.
Yeah.
What's happened to our rock clubs? So, you know, I try to be sympathetic to it because I do think that it's you have to understand it in that larger context of defeat and loss and fear. But you know, Mike, what I find really interesting about the relationship of disco to rock is also that if you look at the earlier 1970s, it's not at all clear that what happened with this great divide between disco and rock mm-hmm. was going to play out like that. I mean, you look at England in particular, and this just fascinated me. David Bowie is, in some sense, the leading edge of it in a certain way. But there's Brian Auger. There's Jeff Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Humble Pie. The Stones, to some extent, too. And they're all, I mean, most of these folks are people who were really affected by, in their growing up, by blues music and R&B. And they're really interested in what Stevie Wonder is doing in the States and Sly Stone.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
James Brown. Bowie, you know, he picks up Carlos Alomar, right? He's mm-hmm. working with him. He's a refugee from James Brown's band, right? And so there's this interesting moment. And in the States, of course, you know, there are other people who are crossing these, who are making it look as though the divide, if there is a divide between black and white music, is sort of archaic or should be.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's just really interesting to me, the fact that there's this transatlantic interest in sort of dismantling, among some people, you know, dismantling the remaining racial boundaries in the early 70s, let's say 73, 74, may go up to 75. And then that doesn't ultimately, I don't know if it's that disco blows up too big or what it is, but it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
Mm-mm. No, because then there's the backlash against, you know, disco blows up. It takes over all these rock stations, all these rock clubs. People hate it.
Right, right.
You know, and then
and
you,
the funny
you know,
thing
you
is,
find, you know, a kind of reinforcement of the racial lines in popular music that then, of course, begin to break down again, because music is like that. Music is about hybridity, and you can't separate sounds, right? Musicians
right.
are always going to seek out the other.
It's funny that you say as far as disco. I mean, the radio stations weren't playing it at first. I mean, people were hearing things like, I guess it was it the Love Theme from Barry White that wasn't played on the radio? They just kind of looked down on it, and it was the clubs, and it was like, who the hell are buying these albums, these records? And it just kind of went to the top, so they had no choice but to play it at first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you could say that probably disco was the first genre, if you want to call it one, I probably would, that broke out not on the radio. You know, I mean, it began to break out in the clubs, and the guys who were working, you know, the radio jocks and the guys doing promotions at the record companies, they were like completely caught off guard. I mean, like when Eddie Kendricks's Girl, You Need a Change of Mind began to get club play, you know, they didn't understand it, and they didn't know it. You know, Barry White's, the big first disco hit, Barry White's hit, that was sitting in a bin of records that were basically due to be trashed at Barry White's, I think it was 20th
That's
Century.
Right. That's right. White's, yeah, it was 20th Century.
Record company. Yeah. And it was spied by a couple of DJs that were there paying a visit, and they started to play it at their clubs, and it got popular, and so then radio was forced to play it. But initially, you know, radio had no idea that this scene was happening or that it would blow up the way that it did. I mean, I don't think anybody knew that.
And the thing is, like, from my own viewpoint, having been like 7 years old in 1977, we just did a show. We tried to do a show on 77 last night, but it did turn into something crazy. So we're going to try to savage that in the edit. But Saturday Night Fever, in many ways, brought disco into the mainstream culture, and it kind of broke it in a way that allowed for its almost overexposure and eventual bastardization. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how, as you're a kid, and again, I'm just speaking from my own experience, mm-hmm. that if you're 7 years old, 7 and 8 years old in 77 and 78, and you have no real sense of a timeline yet, how Saturday Night Fever seemed to be the beginning of a movement. But in reality, mm-hmm. it's kind of like it really came along after the fact, where it was something that, you know, in its purest form had already passed.
Yeah, it's really, and you know, the executives who were working on that, I mean, the film company, they were like, the studio, they were like, they kept trying to speed up the release because they were convinced that disco was going to crash, that it was, you know.
Really?
That, you know, that they would, oh yeah, that they would miss it, you know. And so they were really eager to have that come out as early as possible. I mean, they were really racing, and at least according to what I've read.
Yeah.
And then Saturday Night Fever does change things. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I quote some people in the book who talk about how people, especially in more mainstream clubs, started to dance like, or trying to dance like the people in Fever. but it is just fascinating. I mean, I would love if, I mean, Saturday Night Fever, of course, it's based upon a completely, it's not based upon observation of those disco clubs. It was a story that was written by a British writer.
It's a New Yorker magazine,
I think. Yeah, who published the story in New York Magazine, and it got bought up by Robert Stigwood, and made into a movie. But he really, his source material was really his own experiences as a sort of observing mod culture in Britain quite a few years earlier.
So, go figure.
You know, yeah, I mean, so it didn't, So, I mean, it is true. So, I mean, Tony Manero and his friends, they're, you know, ethnic, you know, they're Italian Americans living in Brooklyn, and they're working class. And
you think,
so it
you
is,
think Saturday
you know,
Night
it
Fever
is
would have
really
worked?
Interesting. And I think that there were, for sure, working class people who listened and danced to disco. We just don't have that history yet.
Do you think Saturday Night Fever would have worked if Tony were gay?
No.
Yeah, it was.
No.
Yeah,
because already, you know, if you look at some of the criticism that came out, it was clear that there were already ways in which the fact that he danced the way that he did. You know, there's that one curious scene where the camera sort of lingers on his body and on him in bed. And I think that there were people for whom, even though the Tony character is undeniably heterosexual, I think that there were people who found him, I mean, there were people who made fun of him as not fully heterosexual.
Right.
So, yeah,
rock
I don't
fans.
Think it would have worked at all. I mean,
people
think about
with
it,
a rock-centric
no...
mentality in 1978 were the ones that were saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it. I don't think it would have worked. I mean, think of how long it's taken. I mean, it really wasn't until the 90s that that began to really shift.
Yeah.
So I think that there was a real utility in having it be a white heterosexual guy.
It's
and making
funny that,
disco safe. Yeah.
It's funny that you said how they were trying to rush the movie out by the end of 77. You know, the movie's released in December, in mid-December, mm-hmm. and, you know, How Deep Is Your Love is already the number one song. It was released as a single, I think, in late October, mm-hmm. early November, and it mm-hmm. already climbed the charts by the time mm-hmm. the movie was released, which was, I mean, you don't see that happening too much. And, you know, with the fear that, okay, disco's going to die, quick, get this out quick, you know, there were never so many disco songs on the pop charts than in 78 and 79.
Yeah.
You know, following yeah. Saturday Night Fever. And
a lot
of them were rock
know.
Groups, you know, as far as like disco influencing rock. And you had that cross-pollination thing where disco now influences rock. And then you see a little bit of rock getting into disco, because everything that started coming out in 78 and 79, you start seeing Heart and the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead and Kiss and Rod Stewart. And they're all releasing these disco-influenced singles.
Yeah, although it's funny, I guess I would take issue with you a bit there, in that I don't really think disco is influencing rock there. I think that you can see what's happening with Sly Stone and Stevie Wonder and those folks as being really, truly influential earlier in the 70s. But I think those records tended to be, I don't know if I mean, yeah, I might agree with you around the stuff.
I mean, they weren't, wasn't the labels maybe pressuring them to like hop on the bandwagon of that beat? Of that disco
yeah.
beat and this and
yeah.
the hi hat and that
yeah.
whole, you know, you heard a lot of that Shakedown Street and Straight On and, you know, Do You Think I'm Sexy, I Was Made for Loving You, even Another Brick in the Wall by Pink Floyd had that same, you know,
mm-hmm.
that same beat.
Mm-hmm. You could be right there. I mean, I tend to see more authentic, if you want, a sort of more, well, even then, it's hard to know. I was going to say Blondie, right?
Heart of Glass.
But you know, they played it both ways in terms of to what extent that was parody or not. You know, but I think eventually, for sure, you really see it working its way after it's died, in particular.
Yeah.
Into like new wave, some new wave, like the Talking Heads, and I would say Blondie.
Yeah,
still,
new wave was already a thing by the time of Blondie. I would think in the case of Blondie, and it may be just like a, you know, some of these things on a case by case basis, but I think in the case of Blondie, they were just looking for what was going to get her to break Blondie commercially.
Yeah,
you know, because they had those,
yeah.
those the punk roots, but what was it really total punk, you know, roots? I mean, even the Ramones go back to Phil, you know, Phil Spector, and, you know, I mean, Joey loved Ronnie Spector, you know, the Ronettes, and it
right.
goes back to that thing. So I think with yeah, in the case
I totally
of Blondie, it was like, okay, what's going to break them commercially?
The idea that, you know, that there is some sort of, you know, kind of pure new wave or punk is, you know,
yeah,
it's fairly dubious, probably. But yes, but, you know, back to Rod Stewart, I mean, I do think that Rod Stewart and some of the other stuff was pretty opportunistic. I mean, it was just like, well, staying on the charts. But I think some of it was, did reflect influence. And then especially later, I would say especially in the 80s, you really see it. You know, you really begin to see, especially in Britain. I think in Britain, they, for whatever reason, they are always sort of more open to music made by black musicians. And so a lot of that post-punk punk, you know, you think even of Gang of Four. I mean, there's, you know, it's not a disco beat, but there's an attention to rhythm.
Yeah, they were more immersed in that. They were more like kind of like the way the Clash was.
Yeah,
where it was like rhythm and politics,
yeah,
know, social
exactly.
justice and socially aware content.
And I think some of that is Jamaican music, which was such an influence on so many of them, from the Clash to John Lydon. I mean, even if the Clash and the Sex Pistols hadn't really liked each other very much, I think, you know, reggae was an influence on both of, you know, the musicians in both of those groups.
Yeah. It was big time. I mean, as far as even the Stones, I mean, Black and Blue, you have
mm-hmm.
The
oh,
influence
yeah.
of that whole album, well, a lot of it. But
yeah, and that comes out, what is that, in 75, 70,
Black
75,
and Blue was
it?
76. It was
it was
weird because they were like doing the tour and then they kind of went to Europe and they released Black and Blue and they didn't tour the States for it. They just did they were still in Europe and they released Black and Blue, which, you know, kind of they did the tour in 75 in the States, and then when they went to Europe and they Black and Blue comes out.
Mm-hmm. Did they record it? I just don't remember. Did they record it, you know, in 76 or 75?
It could have been recorded at the tail end of 75. I'm thinking
uh-huh.
it's released in the spring of 76. So, I mean, they recorded very quickly back then. I mean, you could record an album in January and have it out in mid-February. You know, it was just kind of like, you know, I was talking to somebody about Kiss Love Gun, and we were talking about, you know, again, we're doing a 40th anniversary of 77 this month as well, and Love Gun is released in mid-June. There's speculation that it's now mid-June and not June 30th, but it was recorded between the 1st and the 15th of May, I believe. I don't know what the exact dates, but it was recorded in May. So between that, getting the cover art, to getting the full, you know, everything together, it's recorded and released in under 2 months. So the way they worked back then was a lot quicker. So as far as the release date, the release of Black and Blue, I'm thinking the spring of 76. But I might
be
wrong.
Is that mostly because of the kind of bigger promotional machine now, or is it technological? Is there what's the shift about?
That takes so long for music to come out these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? If you ask me, I believe that trend started in the 80s when you had albums like Thriller come out. And rather than, you know, because it used to be album tour. I mean, the Beatles, if you go from the 60s through the 70s and even into the early 80s, where bands would release an album a year, some of them would release two or three albums a year.
Yeah,
in the case
yeah,
of the Beatles
yeah.
and Kiss. Okay, so when you had something like Thriller come out and you find that you can get 6, 7, 8 singles off an album, the labels started to milk the albums for as many singles as it can get. So, which is why you had that that trend exploding in the mid-80s, you know, Can't Slow Down, Lionel Richie, Born in the USA, Billy Joel, An Innocent Man. You know, each of them had 4, 5, 6, 7 singles off of it. And the run of an album, so where the run of an album would go from 3 months, 4 or 5 months at the most, before they were ready for new product, an album's run would be about 2 years. So artists were now taking 2-3 years between albums because they had that luxury. because the label would milk it for all it could get, and they would go off on these big 2-year tours. So rather than a tour being 2 months, it would be 2 years. And I think that that was a trend that started in the 80s, and it kind of, it's not so much of a trend now, because now you're seeing more artists releasing music more frequently. And I think a lot of them, because the ones that are still around are getting older and they want to work more. So you got people like Bruce Springsteen, who used to take, you know, 5 years between an album. Now he's releasing an album a year. Every 15 months, he's got something new out. So, I mean, that's okay, just so, my take on
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So isn't that fascinating?
It really is. I mean, it's kind of watching this whole thing. It's like America itself, you know. It started off as an experiment, and we don't know where it's going, you know. And it's really not that old. I mean, 200-something years. I don't know how old we are again, 204, whatever it is. It's really not a long time in the scope of history. It's really nothing in the scope of history. And in the case of rock and roll, you know, it comes along 54, 55, you know, rock and roll is here to stay. Rock and roll will never die. You know, it'll go down in history. They're already talking about it like it was a thing of the past, you know, and it wasn't. And the rock stars were, our rock stars were not supposed to get old. You know, it was supposed to be something by the young for the young. And so it's kind of interesting watching the Stones almost be the template for what is possible. Because they're the only ones that are really left that are still doing it. And it's kind of like they're the litmus test. And there's no precedence for this. This is it. We're watching it, and we're still watching it as it's happening. You know, we're watching.
Right.
We're still key witnesses to history as it's happening. And we're losing a lot of rock's first and second generation now. And it's just going to become like everybody.
But it's fascinating. I was just, I got interested, so I went to Wikipedia as you were talking. And according to Wikipedia, now, you know, okay, there's a caveat there, but they actually began recording Black and Blue in December of 74.
Really?
And they were going to release it in time for the summer of 75 tour of the Americas. That didn't happen, but they did a lot of work on that album in 75. And what I don't see right here is when they did Hot Stuff, which to me is among the more, you know, disco-ish
that makes
of
sense.
Those things.
That makes sense, and I'll tell you why. Because if you list the album that they released in 74, it's only rock and roll. Has and if you listen to even Goat's Head Soup, there's two songs. One is Dancing with Mr. D, and Fingerprint File off of It's Only Rock and Roll. And they both have that same Hot Stuff beat. So it's kind of like that beat that rock was flirting with, that was, you know, supposedly influenced by disco, but that beat is already there. And it's proof that, you know, because Goat's Head Soup came out in 73. So it's already there.
Yeah.
The Stones are already playing with that sound. And they tour and said they their tour comes in, you know, into the States in mid-75. It makes sense because Ronnie Wood joined the band for that tour. And I'm thinking, well, okay, he joined for the tour. So it does make sense that maybe they were recording at the tail end of 74.
You know, and, you know, I mean, Billy Preston, of course, is with them.
Yeah.
And he's all over some of those songs.
Yeah.
Harvey Mandel.
I never knew that.
Brown.
I never knew that the recording goes that far back.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. So, I mean, it's... Yeah, the Stones are really fascinating, and that's why, I mean, I think they're very typical with a lot of British bands of that vintage, and that, you know, they have such deep roots in blues music and in R&B. It makes sense to me that they're interested in what's happening in America and American R&B, which is, you know, beginning to shift towards this sort of disco-ish sound. It makes a lot of sense that they would be, and that their colleagues, their compadres, if you will, are also interested in it because they have such deep roots. And, you know, the Stones are still, you know, they're still going back to, obviously, in their new album, to the blues and to R&B.
It was a long time coming with that one. As a Stones fan, you know, and I know a lot of Stones fans, it was a long time coming with that album, because we were just saying, you know, all that post-Steel Wheels part of their career. It was just that. Go back to Aftermath and the beginning of 12 by 5 and the beginning of the Blues Stones. You know, so they finally did it.
They finally did it. But you see, this is an interesting thing. I mean, I'm speaking off the top of my head here, but I think it's kind of true that so many British groups. I mean, it's not just the Stones. I mean, you could look at John Mayall. You could look at so many of them, whose names at the moment escape me.
Right.
You could certainly name them, who were people who really didn't come to rock and roll out of folk music. They come to it out of their love of R&B and blues. And in America, you know, you can find the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and you can find others of whom that's true, but most of the 60s rockers in America, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, I mean, I know Neil Young is a Canadian, but Janis Joplin and Big Brother, Janis probably knew, of all of them, probably knew much more about the blues than anybody else. Grateful Dead, Pigpen was the Janis there, somebody who knew a lot about blues. But most of those groups, most of those big 60s musicians who were U.S.-based were really influenced by folk. They didn't have such deep roots.
Which is why the British invasion was so important, because they were literally, I mean, after the founding fathers disappear at the end of the 50s, you know, we lose, mm-hmm. you know, Elvis goes in the army, he goes on his horrible, horrible trajectory of a film career. And Chuck Berry and Little Richard, you know, you had this period in American music between, say, 59 and 63, where mm-hmm. it becomes bubblegum pop, and you have Fabian and, you know, the Beach, Frankie Avalon and the Beach movies, and rock music becomes safe again. And you mm-hmm. have the British bands, the Stones and the Beatles, and like you said, Paul Butterfield, like all these people that are absorbing all of this R&B and blues, and it's American music, and they in a way brought that back to the States.
Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely.
And just like reintroducing America to its own music.
I mean, there's a great quote, I think it's from Paul McCartney, who was on one of their first tours in America as the Beatles, and he said, don't you people even know about your own, something like, you know, your own history, your own musicians? And he was talking about, I don't have it in front of me, okay, so don't hold me to it, but he was talking about American musicians, mm-hmm. and he was just shocked at the level of ignorance, you know?
I think that's the
and
case
so,
today with a lot
yeah,
of things.
I mean,
but yeah, you're right.
You know, it is really interesting, so in some sense, it's no surprise that some of the people who were most interested in what Sly Stone and what Stevie Wonder were doing were British rock musicians. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, my favorite Jeff Beck song is a Stevie Wonder song. So, you know, I think some of the best things. Oh, and I'm not even talking about, I forgot about Superstition. But he did a song called Because We Ended As Lovers, which Stevie wrote. And it's on an album called Blow by Blow, which is one of my very, very favorite guitar albums. It's just one of the best things ever recorded. George Martin produced it. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But if you ever want to hear just like some really great, mellow, jazz influenced guitar instrumental, it's Jeff Beck. I mean, he's one of the great, he's one of the legendary rockers, but he's also just a great artist, and it's his masterpiece. So yeah, that's my plug. That's my inadvertent plug for the show to Alice Eccles. Is Jeff Beck Blow by Blow, because I, you know, and I pulled it out of my collection about a week or two ago, and I've been playing it in my car a lot, so it's just kind of, it's on my mind.
It's a fascinating moment, you know, 72, 73, 74.
It really is.
It's a really interesting moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could add to that list Eric Burdon, who's been, you know, working with War, right? It's just...
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I would actually really like to do more work on. And, you know, I can't remember if it was Jive Talking or not, but it might have been Jive Talking. And I know I tell this story. So Mick Jagger was at a party, and this would have been just before the release of the Bee Gees' Jive Talking.
Okay.
And he heard this unreleased, I think he was listening to the whole unreleased main course, and it was at one of, which was the album that Jive Talking was on.
Yeah.
And so it was at one of Stigwood's parties. And Mick Jagger says, "That's effing dynamite. Who's that? Some new group you've signed up?" And, you know, it turned out to be the Bee Gees. And so, you know, it's always great to go back and look at the reaction at the time, because I'm sure, I mean, now, I mean, you know, I don't know what the Bee Gees are saying right now, but they themselves,
only one of them
for
left
the
alive.
Longest time, were just disparaging of the work that they did in the disco era. I mean, some of it was really great, all those, you know,
in a way, they were a new. In a way, they were a new group, because they transcended their sound transformed their sound so much that they really did sound like there was like two eras of the band. I'm sorry, totally like cut off your thought there.
Oh well, I was just going to say, you know, I think that some of their music in that disco period was great, and some of it was just, you know, very unfortunate.
once they tried to ride the wings of Saturday Night Fever, and they got into that Spirits Having Flown record, and Tragedy, and too much, you know, too much heaven.
Yeah, that terrible stuff.
Yeah, it was just kind of like, okay, this is peaked. Now it's all downhill. You know, you can't. What do you do after Saturday Night Fever? That's the curse of something that, of releasing something that's going to be that big. And I think that's the case with anybody. Any artist.
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely.
Once you release your masterpiece.
You look at everybody who was big in that period. I don't know if I'd say that about Barry White, because he just sort of kept chugging along in a certain way. But if you look at, I mean, because he then cut Ecstasy. I can't remember the date of Ecstasy. But, you know, he eventually obviously loses popularity. But you look at the efforts of so many people who have been big, whether it's the Village People or the Bee Gees or Donna Summer, and you know, there's this desperate effort. You know, you see this with Donna Summer. You see it with the Village People. I'm not so sure about the Bee Gees, but those first two, you know, it's like, oh, we got to go new wave. You know, we've got to get those guitars in. You know, it's just, you know, and it worked a bit for Donna Summer. I mean, she was very talented.
I know you've talked to her. And how much effect did Donna Summer have on, you know, women's liberation and the whole, you know, going back to her, just her influence?
Well, I think if we were able to go back to 1975. You were to go to a meeting of, if you were to go to a NOW meeting, National Organization for Women, you would probably find a lot of people there who thought that Donna Summer's music was terrible. And they may even have thought, some of them, that it was too sexual. But, you know, even people like Andrea Dworkin, who was once a very, she's no longer with us, once a very famous radical feminist, who was a real early campaigner against pornography as exploiting women, which, by the way, you know, Jesse Jackson and a lot of people, some people in civil rights, were also against disco as pornographic music. Okay, so there were a lot of people who may have thought that, including some feminists, but when they decided to go out for a drink later and they went to a disco, I'm sure, and I've been told, that even Andrea Dworkin would get on the dance floor and dance. So I think that it's complicated. I mean, it's not the case that, you know, for the most part, you can't say that Donna Summer's music was celebrating women's liberation. On the other hand, there is a way in which the way in which she and so many other, whether it's Chaka Khan, Selma Houston or whoever it is, I would say particularly Chaka Khan and particularly the musical trio LaBelle, the way that they put out in a way that really hadn't been since the era of the blues, or you could point to Janis Joplin too, they really were unashamed about the way that they sang about women's desire. And that was new. I mean, that's not something you had heard a lot of in rock music. You heard it much more in R&B. And so it's not a surprise in a certain sense that, you know, disco growing out of R&B would sort of carry that tradition on. And I think that, but I wouldn't say that it was explicitly feminist, but it did put women's voices out there. And there were, you know, I mean, I think that was one reason that some people didn't like disco, was that it was so female dominated, with the exception of the Bee Gees. Of course, the Bee Gees had their falsettos, but yeah, with the exception of the Bee Gees and Barry White and a few others, the Village People.
Any movements of like pride or empowerment, people get so friggin' offended over. It just seems like those type of things that people just get, that are just bothered by. And
well, I think particularly in times when it seems as though the country is unsettled, it seems as though it's in decline, it seems as though, you know, people who, you know, in, I would say this in both eras, people who have lived fairly comfortably, not rich, but fairly comfortable, begin to feel, as I said earlier, and here I'm borrowing a line from a book by a sociologist named Arlie Hochschild, that they are strangers in their own land, that something is happening and certain people's voices are being heard now. And now it could be trans people, it could be lesbian, gay people, it could be still, again, people of color. It's just, and there's a way in which they feel unheard. People who are white and of multiple classes. It's like the culture is changing. And so I think that that's pretty typical. I mean, it's happened in Europe. Partly it's globalization. But, you know, and immigration and the circulation of that which isn't familiar. But, I mean, I agree with you. People do get worked up over it, yeah. And stuff happens. I mean, politics changes because of it.
Regarding Donna Summer, I mean, her career explodes around 70. I mean, Love to Love, the initial single that was in question, you know, and one of my favorite quotes from her is, and I think it was an interview that you did with her on a radio, was it something that you were part of, where she says, you know, my parents said it wasn't a good display of my vocal abilities. And I thought that was hilarious. But, I mean, she doesn't have she releases a few albums after that. They don't really have hit singles, but, you know, she explodes with Last Dance, 1978, Thank God It's Friday, and Bad Girls was mm-hmm. just monumental. I mean, I call it the Highway 61 revisited of disco, you know. It's just
this
big,
right.
Big,
it's
monumental,
yeah,
masterpiece of hers. And then on the radio, you know, the greatest hits album, and the way it was cut, where the songs just siege into each other, like it was done like, yeah, like a DJ cut of it, where everything, yeah, goes into each other. But that whole moment where, I mean, disco peaks commercially, 78, 79. And then you have that moment in August 79. And several people have cited this. And I don't know. I guess it's more of a symbolic moment than anything real or that can be proven. But the moment My Sharona by The Knack hits number one and disco is officially, quote unquote, declared dead. Mm-hmm. Right. Where did that come from? Was it like Echoes of Comiskey Park? Was it just like this collective backlash that they're trying to insist that disco is dead? Like, what was that all about?
Okay, well, there's one thing I want to say before I answer that, which is about Donna Summer. And it's that one of the things that I think Dave Marsh is the person, the rock critic Dave Marsh, who really clued me into this. And I began listening to her differently after I read him about Donna Summer. And this would have been while I was working on Hot Stuff. So sometime, let's say 2004 or 2005, I don't know. And he talked about how Marauder and Summer were like the equivalent of rock auteurs, right? Like, you know, people would talk about Trudeau, the French filmmaker, as an auteur, somebody who was really a true artist, who was in control of whatever it was that they were making, right?
Right.
So, and we never think of disco artists as being auteurs, right? We think of them as, you know, fulfilling the dictates of the producers. And Donna Summer was herself, you know, she started out in rock and roll. And
right.
So, and her, she was a big Janis Joplin fan. And so, in a certain sense, she's not unlike, you know, I've talked a lot about the British rockers who were interested in sort of further expanding their musical palette and taking on board what was happening in this new kind of R&B that would later come to be sort of understood to be disco or the beginnings of disco. There are also black artists like Sly Stone, like Stevie Wonder, like Chaka Khan, like Donna Summer, who were also interested in mixing it up, right? And so, like, I would say, David Bowie's bassist. I can't remember her name, the black woman who backed up David Bowie for years.
I know who you're talking about. I don't know her name either.
Yeah, but you can find it. And she talked about herself as, I think, as working within the register of the Black Iraq. You know, very funny.
I never heard that.
Right, right. I mean, I just found that recently.
That's
and
funny.
So I think it's again, that's one of the interesting things. It's like, didn't have to end up the way that it ended up. It's so polarized. But to get to your point of, you know, why did that happen? You know, why was it consigned to, you know, the dustbin of history?
While all of this popular disco was still on the charts, I mean, just overnight,
yeah,
literally within the course of a week, you know, disco is, yeah, now dead. How do you just declare something dead? And who are these people that decide that something's dead? And all of a sudden, new wave is in, and now new wave is dead. But yeah, I just thought that disco is now symbolically declared dead.
Yeah,
and
it is. It is really fascinating. I mean, you know, sure, Comiskey Park played a role, but I think that one of the stories that I tell there in the book, and again, remember, we're talking 2017, and I wrote that book in 2009, and I've since written another book, so, you know, I'm going to be vague on the details, but there were these two radio consultants. These were people who would consult radio stations about what they should be playing, about where they should be moving, should they, you know, move into this genre, should they cut back on that? And they came forward with, I mean, they did testing of people. You know, I think some people have, I mean, one can take issue with, I think, how accurate that testing might have been. But in any way, in any case, they presented their findings to a bunch of influential radio stations. And I think that those radio consultants, I think I first read about this actually in the Village Voice in the 80s. I used to be an avid reader of the Voice.
I miss the Village Voice. And you know what I mean, because it's not what it was.
You had Bob Christgau, you had, you know,
yeah,
all of these. Ellen Willis would,
Nat
she pretty
Hentoff.
Much wasn't writing music then, but writing about music. But I mean, it was just great. And so I think that their work was very influential. And I do think that, you know, it's a little bit like the stock market, you know. It runs on emotion. It runs on sort of what seems to be in the air and where things might be moving. And there was just this stampede to, you know, to move away from disco.
Yeah, I guess so. When I mean, where do we hear it today? Where do we hear disco today? Is the authenticity of disco where even traceable in today's dance music, or is it just something that is it considered roots music now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think for some people it is a kind of roots music, and you know, I have to say it's so funny to read. If you go back and you read the criticisms that were made of disco as being prefab and formulaic and producer's music and it's just funny, because if you compare it to today's dance music, I was just going to say that.
Like, where do you hear? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that cite disco as influential, but you know, that compressed, airtight, auto-tuned, shitty sound is anything but that massive, majestic production of those disco records of the 70s. You know, Nile Rodgers, listen to Chic.
Yeah.
I mean, listen to that stuff.
It's so funny, because it actually owes more to sort of the wall of sound. I'm not saying that that's a major influence, but, you know, it just doesn't sound, I mean, producer-wise, it sounds production-wise very, very different from what from today's dance music. But I do think that, I mean, I certainly hear, I mean, I listen to, like, Lorde's Greenlight. I mean, that sounds disco to me. I mean, it's different in that it has, the production sounds, unfortunately, up to date, but musically, I mean, I think Katy Perry, to me, it's not very, I mean, it bears a very strong, I mean, it shows its indebtedness to disco.
Like, is Katy Perry, like, to disco's evolution, what, say, 21 Pilot, is it 21, you know, Death Cab to Cutie is to mm-hmm. rock and roll's evolution. You know, can it still be considered disco? Can it be part of that lineage, that line that goes back to Stonewall and the development of disco's sound in the 70s? Can it be part of that? Can it be seen as part of that line? What
Katy
Perry is doing
today?
Yeah,
I think it can, but I mean, I think one of the most curious things about disco is think about, let's say, even Bad Girls or Hot Stuff. I mean,
had a
either,
rock beat.
I mean,
you hear more rock in those songs.
Yeah, it's true. I'm trying to think of something. I Feel Love. That's more leading towards where one branch of disco is going to go, which is Euro disco.
And that's the sound that Moroder crafted. And you were talking about, you mentioned
that's
Giorgio
right.
Moroder. I want to just get back to him and almost, you know, maybe end on this note, because I know, you know, I said maybe like half hour, 45 minutes, and we're well over an hour now. So I don't want to keep you too long. But a good note to end on as far as the Giorgio Moroder and just that auteur thing that you were talking about, as far as the artist and where the producer became important. Again, where almost like the sound that Donna Summer, the stuff that was coming off of those Donna Summer records was also the art of Giorgio Moroder. It was all, there were also Moroder records. They weren't just Donna Summer records. And I think Moroder was to Donna Summer what George Martin was to the Beatles. You know, where you have
very much true.
Sergeant Pepper, you know, it was 50 years since Sergeant Pepper. I made the argument that it's not just a Beatles record, but that's a George Martin record. Like, that's George Martin's baby, as far as I'm concerned. You know, he's all over. Take him out of the equation.
Right. I wouldn't disagree with you, but I think that rock artists in the late 60s and through the 70s, they were quite eager to put themselves, and they very often did put themselves in the role of producer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at Joni Mitchell. I mean, really, she produced, after a point, she produced her own work, I'm pretty sure, with the help of the engineer that she worked with.
Right.
But there was a sort of pride in not being produced by anybody else. But you're absolutely right. I mean, George Martin, huge. I mean,
it's kind of like Moroder and George Martin did for the producer what Hitchcock did for the director. You know, where films in the 30s were all about the producer and Selznick, and then Hitchcock came in and into Hollywood, and it became, you know, an Alfred Hitchcock, you know, directed by, it became his thing, you know, where the directors, and that I kind of see Moroder as the in that role as far as disco goes. And Nile Rodgers, of course, because Nile Rodgers went on to produce
Nile
a lot.
Nile Rodgers, hugely so, yeah. And then I would say, you know, there were other people too, lesser lights like Gene Page. I hope I'm remembering his name correctly.
Yeah,
he worked
with
Barry White. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's very much true. But I also think that's one of the reasons that rock artists were so leery of disco. It's like, you know, think it's fair to say that in the last, you know, from about the 80s onward, it was much more typical for rock artists to really work with producers in a way that gave producers more, probably more power. But in the 60s and for a part of the 70s, I think that there was this sort of cry of independence. You know, we don't, you know, yeah, we're going to work with these people, but, you know, it was sort of under sufferance, right? So I do think that that was one of the reasons that there was this kind of hold your nose, disco sucks. But I was going to say about this interesting question that you raise around when you talked about Death Cab for Cutie and its relationship. I mean, is this rock? I mean, I think almost everybody would say that what passes for what we understand as rock today is rock. But when it comes to, let's say, Katy Perry or some of Lorde's tracks that are more danceable, or, you know, you name it, that it's not disco. And there's a way in which disco is sort of sequestered. It's like contained within this sort of 5-year period, or some people would say 4-year period or something,
yeah.
You know? And it's
still
curious to me. I mean, I don't, I mean, I guess, I
it
mean,
never
you could
died.
Do what Tim Lawrence did. And Tim Lawrence wrote another really, you know, useful book about disco, Love Saves the Day. And he talks about how, I mean, he has really sort of framed it within a history of dance music. I mean, that's pretty baggy because an awful lot goes into dance music. But I do think it's really curious that when we talk about rock, rock can encompass Chuck Berry. It can encompass the Beatles. It can encompass John Mayer, Grateful Dead. It can encompass Can. It can encompass everything.
And
but when
Cab.
We're talking about disco, we tend to limit it to, and I suspect it's because it was supposed to have died, but come on, anybody who's listened to George Michael, to Michael Jackson, to Madonna.
Madonna, I was just going to say, I mean, it's really survived.
It's
it just
like,
evolved through the 80s.
On.
That's all it was. It was just natural evolution that happened. And it just got marginalized to this one little thing called disco, this era. And almost like they wanted to forget about it.
Right. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it was one of my favorite quotes in my book Hot Stuff is, I forget who says this, but it's like, yeah, you know, the culture said disco was dead, but, you know, it wasn't to us. We were still dancing. You know, we still had music to dance to.
And the music
Plenty
never stopped.
It was like, you know, so I think, and I was DJing in that period in the post, you know, after disco had apparently died. And believe me, Prince, Madonna, as I said, Prince, Madonna, Michael Jackson. I mean, there was no, and all of the sort of, there's an awful lot of interesting funk, you know, there's the Gap Band, there was Rick James. I mean, however you feel about Rick James, but, there was Tina Marie, you know,
right.
I mean, there was just, great
I guess
music,
it just wasn't
so.
Being called disco at the time for whatever reason. It was just like, you know, there was different variations on it, kind of like rock, the way rock is splintered into all these different subgenres, you know,
mm-hmm.
And disco is almost like, you know, I remember it being like there was club music. A lot of it was just club music.
Yeah.
Like I listened to club or, you know, freestyle in the 90s.
Right.
You know, but
right.
I guess it all has its roots in disco.
It all does, you know, and some people can cope with that and some people can't.
Techno, house, but, all these different variations on the genre, you know?
Yeah.
And the same thing has happened to rock music. It's splintered into so many different, you know, grindcore and deathcore and this core and that
mm-hmm.
core and new metal and old metal. I don't know. It's just rock
mm-hmm.
and roll, man. It's just right. It's only rock and roll. But I like it.
It's true.
But anyway, Alice, this was great. This was much more than I expected. And, you know, I'm looking at the time. I'm going to give this its own episode. This is going to be,
okay.
You know, it's going to be, I think we're going to do two episodes out of this, like part one and part two of our disco years episode. I don't know.
Okay.
But I'm going to definitely do that. I'm going to release it on its own because it deserves to be on its own. Just totally far surpassed my expectations of what this conversation could be, you know, and we covered a lot of stuff that I wanted to talk about. And more.
Well, I have really enjoyed it.
It was just a conversation to end all conversations with this topic. I'm going to release this as its own episode. This was awesome.
Well, listen, it's been my pleasure, Mike, and, you know, just really, it's been fun.
And for our listeners, again, it came out in 2009, but it's Hot Stuff, Disco and Remaking of American Culture by Alice Eccles. Thanks again for joining us.